Hi, and welcome to Common Denominator, straight up conversations with me, Moshe Popek. Each week, I chat with pioneers, innovators, and truly inspirational people from all walks of life to learn the steps they take to turn their ideas into reality. My goal is to empower you to dive in, be bold, and take profound steps toward realizing your own potential. May is Melanoma Awareness Month. Melanoma is the deadliest form of skin cancer, and the American Cancer Society projects over 7,000 Americans will die from the disease in 2021. Our guest this week is TJ Sharp, once diagnosed with stage 4 melanoma. Doctors told him he'd be lucky to live 2 years, but now, 9 years later, he's cancer-free, an endurance athlete, and powerful advocate for cancer patients. I've asked TJ to share his story of perseverance, triumph, and gratitude. Next on Common Denominator.
This is Common Denominator, straight up conversations with Moshe Popek. Now, here's Moshe.
TJ, thanks so much for joining us and welcome to Common Denominator.
Awesome. Thanks, Moshe, for having me here. It's great to be here.
So take us back to August 2012.
In August of 2012, my wife and I gave birth to a little boy named Tommy. He joined his older sister, Josie, and we had this perfect little family of four. I worked as an IT project manager. My wife's a lawyer. We had a great little life down here in South Florida. I got home from work one day with what I thought was a spiking fever. Jen took the kids out to see her brother, and I just rested for the weekend. And I finally said, all right, something's wrong here. Let me go to the ER and just make sure that I'm not going to get our baby sick. The ER doctor had me do a chest x-ray. And he took one look at the chest x-ray and said, with your history of cancer and these spots on your lungs, I think you have a recurrence of your melanoma. And I was floored. I thought, hey, doc, you grabbed the guys next to me. You know, you grabbed the wrong chart. You switched this up somehow. And he didn't. And he said, I think I need to admit you to the hospital and we need to figure out what's going on with you.
In other words, you're hearing that after that initial diagnosis that you had back in 2000, now it's 12 years later.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
You must have been going through a tremendous amount of emotions and feelings.
I didn't know what to feel. You mentioned I had actually had a melanoma, a small stage 1 melanoma. So it was a cut it out and forget about it. And for me, melanoma was something that happened in my past. I kind of got over it and I'm good to go. I just wear lots of sunscreen and long sleeve shirts. And then I heard it was back. Turns out the melanoma was the same one that had been in my body for 12 years. It just took that long to recur.
Wow. So 16 days you're in the hospital. Tell us a little bit about that.
I thought maybe I'd be there for a night. And the next day that the test started, they said, wait a minute, there's spots over here. There's a spot in your lung. There's this big mass on your small bowel. And you don't have much to do in the hospital besides sit there. Yeah. So I had my laptop and I started Googling melanoma and understanding what it was like to go from stage 1 to stage 3 and stage 4. That means your tumors are starting to spread. It's no longer something you can just cut out. There wasn't a quick fix here and stitch me up and put a little more sunscreen on. Yeah. This was something serious. Once I finally got my diagnosis, I recognized that with the standard of care at the time, which was chemotherapy, that the median lifespan was 18 months. Half the people with what I realized I was being diagnosed with, they weren't going to make it a year and a half. And 90% of them wouldn't live to see 5 years. And I all of a sudden started recognizing, oh my God, this is potentially my future. What can I do? What am I going to do about this? And the first step for me was I had a good doctor there and he guided me through. The first thing we need to do is get this big tumor out of you. Because if it ruptures your small intestine, you could die of sepsis, not of cancer.
Right.
And so it was take care of this first. And it was a step-by-step process. At the same time, I always had my eye on what was next. I knew that I needed to get through this direct hospitalization, but that something else was going to happen. And I began doing my research. It's the internet's a wild, wild place sometimes.
Yeah, it's funny because I have 9 kids, and always when my kids are not feeling well, my wife will pop on the internet. And like exactly to your point, it is a wild place and you can go many places. But I always say, you know, go back to your doctors. And I know you probably, I know that you did. You had a, you got a few opinions. How many opinions did you end up getting?
I had 4 second opinions.
Wow.
And that's quite abnormal. Most people listen to what their doctor says for better or sometimes for worse. And this, the oncologist that was there, he told me, here's your standard of care. And I knew that wasn't it. And I know we'll talk about that in a minute. That wasn't my choice. That wasn't the path I was going to go. Mm. But my wife didn't, she didn't spend 16 days in the cancer center. And she asked the doctor, what are we looking at? What's the prognosis here?
Right.
I remember it to this day. He said, I'll be surprised if your husband's here in 2 years.
Wow.
And it was one of those moments where that was the resolve moment. I go, all right, I'm going to be here in 2 years. I know that there's something better out there for me, and I'm going to find what that is.
Yeah. No, that, I'm saying that that's tremendous resilience. I'm thinking about, you know, just the process of getting 4 appointments with 4 different oncologists. It's not easy. And then you have to make a decision. So take me back there. So in other words, what was your decision at that point?
The thing for me was that there is this new phase of oncology research and cancer treatments coming through called immunotherapy. And in those 16 days, I had read all about it. And I knew that that melanoma was at the forefront of all this. And I wanted to be on a clinical trial. I couldn't find the right treatment for me around where we lived. No one had a trial that was open. I did have one of the doctors down here recommend I go see a man named Jeff Weber at Moffitt Cancer Center. It's in the Tampa area, 4 hours away. And so when I got there, it wasn't just, this is what we have, take it or leave it. He gave me a choice. Here's 2 different clinical trials. Here's your standard of care. Here's what you can expect. He really gave me some depth around what my options were. And he then put it on me. And he said, what would you like to do? I talked to him and I said, what would you do if you had 2 little kids and you were 37 years old and you wanted to see them grow up? What would you do? Forget the statistics and all the other stuff. What would you do if this was you?
By the way, that's an excellent, excellent question. And it's exactly what I would have asked.
And that's how I approach a lot of things with my life. You know, I valued his opinion. He was 100 times smarter than I was about melanoma, but I recognized that it was my decision to make. And he said, I would do this new trial.
Yeah.
It's a phase 1, which means it's the first time we've tried this. And I would give that a shot because I think there's a good chance that combining these 2 medicines, it could actually give you that response that you want.
And that's what you do. So you're in Tampa, you're doing this clinical trial. So walk me through what happens after the trial ends. Where are you at that point?
So there's a bunch of things that happened in the middle of that. My trial was really involved. It involved a couple different medications. It was 2 different hospital stays. Yeah. At one point, I got a colostomy bag that I had for 2 years because there was a diverticulitis, and if they would have done part of the treatment, it probably would have killed me. And they said, well, you can either stop the trial or keep going and get the colostomy bag. And I said, is this still the best thing for me? He said, yeah. I said, well, we're going to do it then. And we go through all of this. You know, I take half of my lung out. I get the colostomy bag. I go through this kind of difficult treatment. We're there for 3 or 4 months. And then it doesn't work. We get scan results a few weeks later. And he said, you know what? A couple of your tumors got smaller. But the ones that we're measuring, the biggest ones, they're getting bigger and more showing up. So I don't think we can wait another couple of months to see if maybe that's like there's some immunotherapies where the effect is that your cells, the good cells, the T cells, they get the cancer out of there, but it makes it look bigger on a scan. Well, we didn't have that time. If he was wrong, if that wasn't what was happening, then I was in trouble. So he said, I'd recommend you start on a different therapy as soon as you can.
When you're hearing that, what's going on in your existence, in your mind?
It's disappointment and resolve. And we gave it our best shot. This was what we thought was the best thing. And it's disappointing it didn't work, but that was a known outcome. I knew that that could have happened. It's clinical research. That's what happens. I think, all become more familiar with what research does now in the last year or so. I got that I could fail. And before I got to the point of him telling me that, I already knew what I wanted to do next. So I mentally prepared myself. If this doesn't work, what's our plan B? We're ready to go. What's our plan B? And that was the resolve part.
No, I think of the words, failure was not an option ever. It just was not an option, which is so important. So you go ahead and you decide to take this second clinical trial.
I was fortunate. Someone who knew me through the advocacy world, I was writing a blog in the Philadelphia area where I grew up, and she contacted me and found me this other trial. And we were now faced with the decision, all right, do we stay with this amazing team? Or do we go to this small cancer center here in Fort Lauderdale and say, hey, you might not be the world, you might not have all those big banners on the wall as an amazing cancer researcher, but you have the medicine that we think is actually going to potentially be the best next option. And that was a hard decision. And we came back to Fort Lauderdale and started a trial at a tiny hospital that's got a fraction of the patients that someone like Moffitt has,
sure,
but had the medicine that I wanted and gave me the chance to get on a trial that ultimately has produced a pretty good end.
So in other words, after the trial, you got results back and you were clean.
So it took me about 2.5 years in the trial before that we finally said that this is, we think that we're good. The medicine worked almost right away, but it's not binary. It's not like you either have cancer or you don't. It started to slowly eat away at the cancer. And about 18 months into the trial, so about 2 years into my journey, we got to the point where we're like, this might actually be a complete response where you don't have cancer anymore. And I stayed in the trial for another 2 years. I was getting the medicine, which I knew kept me okay. I was giving some knowledge to science. You know, I kind of felt very altruistic in that way that someone's going to benefit because I got on this trial. So I did that. And finally, like 2 years later, almost five years to the week that I got diagnosed, we got a scan report and it said there's no detectable cancer in your system.
That's amazing. That's amazing. From a global, I guess, perspective now, how would you say cancer, having cancer and going through it, how has that actually, in practical, how has that changed your life and your view on life?
There's been a lot of healthy moments because of it. I've tried to cherish more of the things that I have, the opportunities that I get. I certainly feel like I hate to say obligation, but in the world of survivorship, I've gotten to know a lot of cancer patients along the way. I've gotten to know quite a few that aren't here anymore, including people that have inspired me, that have helped me get into the career and advocacy that I have right now. And I recognize that I have an opportunity as a voice, being here, working in the clinical research industry, that I can make change. I can affect change for other people who have no idea that I ever did anything, but that God kept me here for a reason. Yeah. And that gets me up most days and gets me going.
Once all the noise fades away, I always say it's just like a complete sense of living in gratitude in every moment. If you can get there, it's the hardest work. Hopefully people don't have to suffer to get there, but it's a true freedom because it's not that you need anything. You're okay in peace by yourself, and each moment that you're able to be here in this world, it's amazing. It's amazing. It's true. It's a true gift. I know also you've embraced physical fitness. Tell us a little bit about that.
When I was diagnosed, when I first went in that hospital, I had a little bit of the extra baby weight on that. I thought that was only supposed to happen to moms, but apparently the dads get it too with the sympathy pounds. And I was I'm like, all right, I'll get back in shape as soon as I can help, get over this hump. And then between the hospitalizations and the surgery and all, I ended up losing about 50 pounds. And that was, the first 15 or 20 were probably good ones to go, but the rest of it was strength, it was muscle, it was, I'd played sports and was an athlete in college, and I prided myself on not being, I'm no super jock or anything, But I enjoyed the competitiveness of playing sports, of pickup basketball or hockey or playing football on every Thanksgiving. And all of a sudden, I couldn't do that. And I was resolved to turn that around. And I remember the very first time that I really got into that, I was lighter, so I started running some more. It was good to just get that cardiovascular. And I could actually breathe either because I wasn't quite as heavy. But I'm like, I need to build that strength up. And we did a run. I had both of the kids in a double stroller. It was a 5K or a 5 mile run. And you could choose when you get to the one path. And I remember getting up to the path and I looked down and Josie was probably about 4 years old. And I said, what should we do, guys? Should we go quick back to mom or should we do the long one down by the river? And she goes, Daddy, do the long one. Yeah. And I go, what did I just promise her? I'm like, all right. I go, I got an extra 2 miles on here. I'm like, I can do this. And I remember running through that finish line and thinking, hey man, remember that first doctor that said you wouldn't be here in 2 years? What's like, it's like almost 2 years, in a couple of months. I go, I'm going to send them this picture. I'm going to write a blog about this. And I did. I wrote a blog about it. Yeah. And I put the picture up there. I go, you know what? I bet you'd be pretty surprised to know that I'm running 5 mile runs with the kids. It became important to me to know that I could do that. As someone who had been somewhat into physical fitness his whole life, I wanted to know that I can get back to doing, I needed to know that I could still do not everything. I wasn't going to be able to play college football again, but I want to be able to run with my kids. And you know what? Part of that, Moshe, was that I wanted not just me to know, but I wanted other people that were going to get that you have cancer talk from their doctor. They're going to hear, they're going to start reading about this guy in Florida that's doing these runs. I wanted them to know that they could do it too, that option exists for them. And I can't promise it to you, but I can give you hope. Yeah. And that kept me driven through a half marathon and a couple triathlons, even in one of those tough mutters.
Yeah, that's really, I know I have a few friends that run triathlons. It's not easy. Let's just put it that way. No. So that's really amazing. And I know I'm a big believer in paying it forward. And I know that you're doing that in your professional life. So tell us a little bit about that.
I was an IT project manager, and after my diagnosis and once I started going back into what I thought was a professional career, I said, I even told my dad, I go, I'm never going back to the 9-to-5. Like that's just, there's so much more that I can do in this world. And I felt so unfulfilled by what I was doing. It wasn't for me. It was what I thought I was supposed to do. And there was so little fulfillment out of it. And that led me to a career in advocacy. I love what I do. Is it easy all the time? No, it's not. I speak for the patients that don't have a voice, patients who are going to hear you have cancer or you have this disease or your husband or your father or, God forbid your children have something. I bring that voice to the biggest pharma companies in the world. I bring it to the people who run the trials.
What would you tell people that are going through cancer now or other major hardships that the road looks kind of bleak? What words would you tell people that are going through a real tough time now?
I would tell them the first thing and probably the last thing I would tell them too. I would say stay strong. And when I sign out any of my emails to any of the advocates that I do, I always say stay strong. That's strength to me is the biggest thing. That's physical, it's mental, it's emotional, and that's understanding that you're not going to be bulletproof. I want them to know that they're not alone. Someone else out there can give you help. It might not even be the same disease, but someone's walked the path you're walking or is walking it right now. And if you can find them, two is better than one. Don't be afraid. Don't be too proud to say, hey, I could use a little help with this.
It's amazing. Really. Thank you so much, TJ, for coming in. And if the audience wants to know more about you, how would they be able to reach out or find out anything?
The best way we are in the midst of getting all my blogs back up at tjsharp.com, tjsharpe.com. But the best way on social media to get me is either LinkedIn at TJ Sharp or Twitter at Team TJ Sharp.
Thank you so much, TJ.
All right. Thanks, Moshe.
Hope you enjoyed this episode of Common Denominator. Next week, my guest will be Shira Rubinoff. Shira is a cybersecurity executive and advisor who's built two product companies, leads numerous women in technology initiatives, and was named one of New Jersey's best 50 women in business. And she'll share her story of dedication plus expertise on how you can stay cyber safe. Have a great week, and we'll talk soon.
Thanks for listening to the Common Denominator podcast. Join us next week for another inspiring, impactful, and empowering conversation. To learn more about Moshe, head to moshepopak.com. If you enjoyed this episode, feel free to share it. And we'd be grateful if you could rate, review, and subscribe to the show.